Hey everyone, welcome to the 223rd episode of the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and your co-host,
Kevin Toefel.
And we have an astonishing show for you today. Astonishing because we're going to talk about Amazon finally answering some questions about what it does with your voice data. Plus, we are going to be talking about another smart home platform data leak. We've got D-Link settlement with the FTC over its security failures. We've got a hacked smart home hub that might be put in lots of apartment buildings around the country. We've got some news about HPE and its plan to continue its own digital transformation. Kevin tried out some new software that could replace IFT, or could it? And we've got lots of little updates on products and stuff you probably use. Plus, we have Andy Lowry, the CEO of Realware, as our guest on the show this week. Realware just raised $80 million, and we talked to him about using heads-up displays in industrial settings and why that's taking so long to happen. So, we're going to talk about all of this, plus hear from our sponsor, Dell Technologies. But before we get to that, let's hear from another one of our sponsors. This week's sponsor is Affero. Are you doing multiple IoT projects that work well together? Is there a single app that strengthens your brand? This is really tough stuff, and it requires the right platform. But with Affero, Kenmore launched 42 smart appliance models in just 2 years. And Affero customers realize as much as an 80% reduction in time to market, 99% fewer support calls, and 10x higher activation rates. Plus, they can reuse 90% of their work from one project to the next. So, if you're looking to do multiple IoT projects or just one, pick Affero. Just like Kenmore, Mitsubishi Bank, UFJ Group, and D-Link did. And you can beat your competition with a solution that your team loves to build on and your customers love to use. Learn more at affero.io/gobig. Okay, Kevin, big news on the privacy front this week. Would we call it the privacy front or would we just call it the Madam A front?
Well, specific to Madam A, but it is privacy, so.
So here's the deal, because there's a lot happening here and there's a lot of concern. And I would say these are legitimate questions. So what has happened is journalists discovered a while back that the Amazon Echo, a couple things. One, we all know that it listens for a wake word and that when it hears that wake word, it records what you say so it can actually complete the command, and Amazon keeps the transcript and the actual utterance. A couple weeks back, what people discovered is that there were call centers of people who took the actual utterances and annotated them and checked them against Amazon's actions. And they did that because it's quality control, basically. But people were kind of up in arms. And in general, people are very concerned about having a microphone in their house. And I get it. That's kind of how we got to here. So back in May, a Delaware senator sent a letter to Amazon asking about how long it kept voice recordings, what it did with transcripts, and all of the data it gets used to. So that's okay, right? So the senator's like, hey, we need more information. And this week, Amazon sent it. And people are really, I feel like they're taking kind of the wrong message from this. So Amazon basically says that they're going to retain customers' voice recordings and transcripts until you choose to delete them. If you delete them, it's going to make every effort to delete the voice recordings and the transcripts themselves. But
but the metadata of what was learned from those voice recordings, such as particular actions or skills, that information is not really scrubbed, nor is any information that a skill developer may have received.
Exactly. And nor is any sort of, if you have a recurring thing or there's transactions associated with it, that data is going to stick around because the computer has to have something to work from.
Yeah. If you tell it to set your alarm at such and such time every day, it can't remove the data from that because it would not know when tomorrow to wake you.
So there are a couple things in here that is really important. And I think we should stop having the same conversation about like privacy in these homes, like it's a binary thing, like it's either there or it isn't there. I think we should start having more conducive conversations about how to make sure this data, if people are going to use it, stays out of the hands of people and is used properly. So,
and or is not tied to individuals.
And or is not tied to individuals. So that's a good point. So I think there's a couple things that Amazon could do here. And Google actually already does this. So the senators asked if Amazon takes any measure to anonymize user identity and other information in relation to these transcripts. And the answer appears to be no.
Yeah.
And partly because some of this needs to be associated with your account. You know, if I'm telling Amazon to do something on my account, it makes sense that it has to be associated with my account. Like if I'm buying something from Whole Foods, Amazon needs to know where to send it and that sort of thing. So that's never going to be anonymized. But Google, for example, takes utterances, the actual voice commands, and they run a vocal distortion through it. So they still get the benefit of having the ability to like check their work, as it were, for their AI. So they can do annotations on people's voices. They can make sure that the command actually did what it was supposed to do. They can do all of that without actually knowing you or me.
Right. And I'm glad you brought that up, because if anybody hasn't already done this, you can go into your Madam A app and listen, go through the history and listen to what Madam A actually heard. You will hear your own voice, obviously. And there is a mechanism to report. Did Madam A do what you requested or did she not? So in a sense, you can help train Madam A yourself, and you wouldn't be able to do that, obviously, without having that transcript and history available.
Exactly. So I think first off, to anonymize people's voices is probably a good privacy protection effort, right? Mm-hmm. The other thing I would say is some of these recurring commands, they could probably live locally on the device. And I imagined that both Google, I mean, Google is working very hard for local control on the device. And being able to say, hey, keep my recurring alarm here, then that's great. That's very privacy protecting, right? You get the benefit of having some of the Madam A features without worrying that, you know, everybody knows you wake up at 5 a.m. or whatever time you wake up. That's another thing that I think would be very proactive. And then the other thing is with skills, I think when you download a skill, you should see what data they're trying to get or able to get from a transaction. And you should be able to read their privacy policies, and hopefully they're easy to understand and not like 16 pages of legalese. Those are just some thoughts that I think we need to move forward from, this is scary, there's a microphone in my house, to, hey, if there's a microphone in my house, what are the steps, the concrete steps that should be taken and maybe should they be regulated that will protect people's privacy?
This whole letter, or the response to the letter is only 3 pages long. I highly recommend people read it. There's a lot to parse here, which I think we hit all the high points and the important things. I still have an open question in that one of the responses says, we designed Echo devices and Madam A to use on-device, quote, keyword spotting, quote, technology to detect when a customer intends to interact with Madam A. And it's interesting to me that they didn't say hot word or something to that effect. And I just wonder, is there anything other than the wake words part of that keyword spotting? That's a question I would ask as a follow-up.
That is a good follow-up, because I know sometimes I could think of a perfect use case, right? We are sitting around our dinner table and we're arguing over, you know, something silly, right? And then one of us will be like, oh, well, let's take it to, you know, Amazon. And then we'll be like, Madam A, who was the 42nd president of the United States? And we'll get our response. But when we say things like, let's take it to Amazon, or maybe put it on the grocery list or whatever, I could see, I don't know what the computing action is in my brain. The metaphor is like, you're like, oh, maybe I should pay closer attention. Is it my name? Yes, it is. The only other thing in this letter that, thank you, they explained very clearly how Madam A works, which is it listens for a wake word. When it hears that wake word, it turns on and opens the microphone to take in the voice command that you're going to say. When you stop speaking, it turns that off. It sends only that chunk of command to Amazon and performs that action. Right. And so many people are concerned that it is always listening, and they're just not sure. Like, Amazon can talk till it's blue in the face and explain this, but people are still freaked out about it. So I wish they would have addressed the weird laughing issues, or what exactly is happening when no one in the house has said anything related to Madam A at all, and yet it still wakes up.
Or we've heard probably very edge cases, but something like 2 hours of nonstop recording was actually captured, for example. I remember that happened or was reported about a year ago. Again, I think that's a very edge case. There were some questions about follow-up mode, because in that case, you've said the wake word to Madam A, you say something, and then you may get a response or an action happens, and then you take another action without saying the wake word, and they just continue to listen. But they were clear in the letter, and it has been clear from day one, that follow-up mode, or conversation mode, if you'd rather call it that way, has to be enabled by the customer. So it's not on by default.
Yes. So the point here is, I feel like we should have more transparency. There are always going to be people who are like, no, but this is how these things work. And could Amazon be better? Yes, I think they should take a page from Google. Right now, if you are more privacy conscious, you may want to pick a Google smart assistant for something like this. So we'll see. Hopefully Amazon gets with the program, I guess. I don't know.
These services on whoever makes them, whether it's Samsung, Bixby, or the other two that we just talked about, I mean, they're always evolving. And frankly, if you're going to use one of these devices, yes, you are putting a microphone in your house, and you know that. If you're not comfortable with that, I'd say don't do it. If you're comfortable enough with the way the transcriptions and data are handled, then again, you're fine. If you're not, again, don't put one of these in your house.
Exactly. All right, let's talk about other security issues, because by golly, they are out there. A company called Orvibo has apparently not been awesome. So they left their database open. It is a smart home products maker. They make cheap outlets and other stuff. Like, I can buy an Orvibo smart plug Wi-Fi outlet for $7 on Amazon, which way cheap.
Sounds good.
Doesn't it?
Except they're based in Shenzhen, China, which not by itself is a problem. However, they had over 2 billion logs in their database that was wide open, and there was tons of usernames, emails, addresses, and passwords.
And your precise location. So, this has stuff from around the world. The company that found this is a company called VPN Mentor, and they said they contacted Orvibo via email on June 16th. They didn't hear anything from them. So they tweeted the company, and it was apparently left open until at least July 2nd. So, yay. But you can
basically... So about three weeks from the time they were notified.
Yes. And apparently, it doesn't sound like they actually responded. They just closed it, and the company kept checking, and one day it was shut.
This is something that, like, when we talk about recommended devices for people, because we get tons of questions about what's the best device between this, this, and this, you know, we tend to stick with the more well-known brands.
And they're more expensive.
And they are more expensive. That is correct. Now, that doesn't mean just because it's a well-known brand, it's, you know, your data is secure.
We'll talk about that in a minute.
We will. But I mean, we've even had questions where people were like, hey, when the WiseCams first came out, they're like, hey, my data seems to be going to a server in China. And it's not always known where this data is stored and kept. So, and it's not always easy for us to find out. It's certainly not easy for anyone to find out. You gotta pay attention to that, though, if you can.
And yes, and that's why we say name brands. And I also recommend that you look for companies that have a history of responding to security incidences. By response, I don't mean sue the hacker. I mean, hey, did they issue a patch? Did they, you know, engage with the community? Did they talk to their customer base about it? So those are other things that you should look for when you're buying a connected product. You may not mind, but you know, I certainly don't want my family name, my Wi-Fi password, my device password, and you know, my address.
Your location.
If you know that I turn on my light, I'm like, yeah, that's fine. But otherwise, no. All right. In other security news, D-Link has settled a lawsuit that was filed 2 years ago by the FTC. And the FTC filed this lawsuit saying that D-Link's devices were advertised as secure, but they were not secure. And it was over the security of their routers and IP cameras. The FTC was like, look, you guys stored passwords on your app in plain text. You used hard-coded login credentials. This is a big no-no. That was actually hard-coded login credentials were one of the issues behind the Mirai botnet back in 2016. So all the way back in, well, I guess this was 2016, we were like, really? Hard-coded passwords, you guys? That's ridiculous. That means your password it's stored in the device, which is not a good idea. It's like taping your key to the underside of your mat. I know people do it, but it's not secure. So the FTC said the company was negligent, basically. D-Link was like, we're taking this to court, buddy. And the court was like, no, you didn't send us enough proof, FTC. And the FTC was like, fine, we'll come back. And they did. D-Link is basically, by settling, is probably saying, yeah, okay. Yeah, we did have these things, which it did. And those are not best practices today. Could they have made an argument that back in 2014, when they were building these devices, these were fine? Probably, even though they were not. But we didn't know. Basically, it's like, we didn't know. Now it's clearly a problem. What they're going to do with the settlement is D-Link is going to implement a comprehensive software security program. It's going to include vulnerability testing before they're released and monitoring of its products to address security flaws. It will also issue automatic security updates, and it will begin accepting vulnerability reports from security researchers. These are basic best practices.
I was just going to say, these are all things that we always have recommended, and this should be done. So to me, that was table stakes. I think the bigger thing is that the court settlement requires that D-Link has to have an independent assessment of its software security program. I think it's once a year for 10 years.
Yeah, that's really a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways, you might be like, hey, D-Link is the way to go for the next few years. They've got this impartial reviewer checking out their stuff. A lot of companies actually hire impartial reviewers to security test their stuff. So this is not new, but does this feel like the bare minimum? Yes, but at least we're establishing a baseline. We don't have any laws protecting us, but with the FTC, in this case, we've actually established somewhat of a baseline.
And actually, that brings me to a question I was going to ask you when I took a look at this, because I got the same impression. Here's a baseline. Could it be a model for a particular law, or will the FTC, do you think, just keep going after companies in this way, which would kind of stink? Because, I mean, it took 2 years just to get to this point from the time they filed the lawsuit. So is this a good starting point?
I think so. And I would also say it should not have to be as long of a process because, you know, a court case dismissed the original one, but now they have this precedent. And one, a conservative company will see this and be like, you know what? These are not onerous things. We're doing probably 90% of them. Hopefully they're doing at least 90% of them. And then the FTC can say, great, here's this implemented, do it. And the company will be like, okay, sure. I think where we'll get, again, in trouble is with companies that are not really concerned about pleasing the FTC. D-Link is based, you know, here in the US. They've got millions of customers. When we talk about like some random fly-by-night or just quick hit product, maybe like the smart plug we were just talking about, the Orvivo stuff, those companies may not care. The FTC might go after them and they'll be like, eh. No. So I think it'll be good for conscientious companies. I think it's kind of the bare minimum, but yay, we have a bare minimum and it should be easier the next time to apply.
Baby steps.
So speaking of hard-coded passwords, security researchers have discovered that the Zapato hub, which is actually a hub people have asked us about. I have actually played with it. It's a good hub, except maybe it's not. So security researchers have discovered that it has hard-coded passwords inside, and they could extract those passwords and get access to the hub and control it. But this flaw has now been fixed.
Yeah, and I believe Zapato has an updated hardware, or it's rolling out a different hub for multi-tenant properties, which is where this has been used.
Yes. The reason these guys started hacking it is because one of their fellow hackers had, and we talked about this on the show, was notified by her apartment complex that they were transitioning to a smart apartment building with connected locks. And this security researcher was like, I do not want this, but was unclear if she had the ability to say no as a tenant. And that all kind of, that kerfuffle died down, I believe, to most people's satisfaction. We also saw a different company that was doing automated locks, smart locks in an apartment building. The tenants actually sued the landlord who was trying to put the smart locks in and demanded a physical key. So the bottom line here is this is still an unclear area of law, but the fact that these are maybe not secure or is pen tested is a bit of a problem. And the company is SmartRent, and you may have heard of them because last week they raised $32 million. So what are we saying here? Security is not, it's not at a place where you should be like complacent yet on these devices.
No.
That being said, people can break into non-smart apartments as well. It's just, it's a little bit more difficult. I feel more okay with the smart lock in my single family home because if someone really wants to get in, they can break a window, they can pick a lock. It's not that hard. In an apartment complex, though, having this sort of vulnerability opens a bunch of locks at once, which makes it a richer target.
Right.
And I would also say, if you're, for example, if you have a high risk profile, if you're a hacker or something like that, then you can actually bolster your normal locks that could be easily hacked with a lot more stuff, right?
Right. Other physical things that would make it harder.
So here they don't have that option. Okay. So
yeah,
that is kind of a lot of bad news. The Amazon news, it's good that we've got more clarity here. I'm not surprised by any of it. I do think it's being made out to be a little bit more dramatic than it really is.
And I think that's because of how you started this whole podcast and conversation. It's not a binary thing, privacy or non-privacy, right?
Yeah.
But for many people, it still is.
Yeah. Oh, subtlety. It's the death of us. Hey, let's talk about enterprise IoT. HPE. HPE is HP Enterprises. It is the server and all kinds of other stuff of HP. They've got server software, cloud computing, crazy stuff. We should have done this last week, but we did not. Basically, HPE wants to deliver their entire portfolio as a service by 2022. What the heck does that mean? Basically, and this is interesting because in the industrial IoT, in enterprise IoT, we talk a lot about this concept of digital transformation. The idea is once you have a lot of data about your products, about how people are using your products, you can turn something from a CapEx expense into an OpEx expense, which is cool. And you can deliver all kinds of crazy things like steam traps or elevators or apparently, well, you could always deliver servers as a service because that's what Amazon Right. Web Services is. But HPE, which, you know, builds the physical hardware, I was like, huh, that's kind of crazy. They're still going to provide hardware and their software in a CapEx way. So you could still buy it outright. But mm-hmm. if you want, you can also buy it as a service after 2022. I thought that was really kind of neat they're really pushing forward with what everybody else is trying to do. And I don't know. What do you think, Kevin?
No, I think it's smart. And I mean, Microsoft, for example, they don't really build much hardware. They do some on like the Surface product line and whatnot. But they have all these cloud services, Azure and everything that they have in-house. Whereas HP, I mean, they've traditionally been a hardware company.
Yeah, they've been gear. I mean, they have software on top of their gear. So they integrate software with their gear to give you like a whole, like a data center in a box or networking.
Exactly. But maybe you don't want to buy their boxes because it's cheaper for you to host their services on another cloud. And, you know, they say expanded and new partnerships with CyrusOne, Equinix, and this is easy to pronounce, Google Cloud. So, you know, if you want to use HPE services, you don't have to buy HPE software or hardware. You could have it hosted on a number of providers.
Yeah. So I thought this was kind of cool for the enterprise people because these are the kind of big efforts that we talk about a lot with our guests. And, you know,
And hardware maintenance can be time and money expensive. So, you know, maybe you'd just rather have everybody else manage that in the cloud.
Well, yeah. Personally, I'm like, we're seeing a shift to like the subscription economy, right? So this is basically like, instead of CapEx, instead of buying something big once and amortizing it over time, or depreciating it over time, rather, you just buy it as a service. It's like me buying Rent the Runway instead of doing my clothes or buying my clothes, which, by the way, it's kind of cool. Okay. So let's talk about something that you tried out this week, Kevin.
I did. I tried something out. It's a piece of software for Android or iOS. Runs in the cloud, but you do need an app for it. There is no web interface for it. It's called Olisto. And it kind of touts itself as like a potential replacement or competitor to If This Then That or Stringify or any one of the other integration type services to make your smart home more integrated. And I guess the best way to say this is it's good at what it does. In fact, it has some benefits over If This Then That, for example, but it doesn't do much yet. And that's because there are not a ton of integrations. I dug around. It turns out this product was debuted in 2017 and it's an Amsterdam based company. They created I believe it's a smart thermostat 3 or 4 years ago. And they decided to make this Olisto app and start to integrate other services, not just with their thermostat, but with everything. But when you look at the channels, for example, such as, you know, who it integrates with, there just aren't nearly enough. Nest is on here. You can do notifications. You can integrate with Twitter, cryptocurrency. You can do Wi-Fi monitoring. It does work with Home Connect, Honeywell Lyric, the Trust Smart Home, LifeX, Tune, which is the smart thermostat that kicked this product off, NetAtmo, and then some other names that I'm just not familiar with, like Nuki and Somfy is on there, that I do know them, and Sonos is on there. But eGuardia, Click and Click Uit, I don't know what that is, Crownstone, Woonvelig.
Some of those sound European.
I would say so. In Europe, perhaps this is a good option for you to look at. Here in the US, I don't find it compelling enough. My testing showed pretty good or low latency. I had responsiveness, but I couldn't, for example, hook it up with anything that's on my Wink Hub, nor could I connect it to anything that might be on a SmartThings Hub because that's not supported either. My bulbs, therefore, not supported. I mean, there's just so little that I can do with it. I couldn't send text messages with it. I could have in-app notifications when something happened. And even the Google Home and Madam A integration is kind of weird. You have to create a virtual button and you connect that to your voice assistant and then you put a trigger or what they call a trig on the button. So it's kind of neat that you can create these virtual buttons for trigs because their whole approach is create these triggers that when this happens, what happens next? It's kind of like if this, then that, if that makes sense. It's just weird.
So what does it do better than If? Or what you mentioned that it does some things that If doesn't do.
I'm so glad you asked. You could have multiple when things, multiple triggers.
Ah.
So,
okay.
Yeah. So you could say, if this happens and that happens and this happens only at this time of day, then do this.
Got it. So that's actually more powerful, that's more like a SmartThings or a Stringify effort. So
Correct. And it's far easier to use than a Stringify or a SmartThings. But again, the problem is, for me, and probably I think for most in the US, you want to look at the channels that are offered to see what you can do, or rather what you cannot do. I have no reason to replace anything with this right now. I'm not saying it's a bad product. I'm saying it needs to mature.
Got it. Okay. Hey, let's talk about some tiny little updates that are fun to do. So, Kevin, you want to kick us off with?
Chamberlain. Yes, the MyQ Google Assistant and If This Then That integration, you can get it for free for a limited time. I believe that this is now like $1 a month. We talked about this once before when Chamberlain started charging for the MyQ services on If This Then That. So it does cost you a nominal fee right now, but for 1 year, you can actually get it for free.
Cool. All right. And I will tell you that I love my MyQ. It's great. It's one of the one devices that I'd want to replace here in this house. Lutron, they updated their hub. And so now, instead of 50 bulbs, which was the last limit, it now lets you control 75 bulbs or switches or whatever you want to control, 75 units. So this is great for people with lots of house. lots of lights, lots of switches, lots of lamps. So, yay.
That doesn't require any new hardware at all, does it?
It does not. It's just, well, if you only have 50, now you can go buy 25 more.
So you don't need a new bridge or anything to that effect?
It's the bridge that got the update. All right. Yeah. And speaking of bulbs.
Speaking of bulbs and speaking of bridges, I was actually very excited to see that Signify, the company that is currently the owner of Philips Hue, I guess is the best way to say it.
It's the lighting division of Philips that spun out and is now called Signify, and they own the Philips Hue bulbs.
Yes. Well, I never really invested in the Philips Hue bulbs because I just didn't want another darn box in my house, and you need that. Or do you? Going forward, you may not, because Philips Hue now makes bulbs with Bluetooth. So you could get Philips Hue bulbs, both white, tunable white, and color with Bluetooth, and no Philips Hue bridge needed.
Woo! I am curious what you'll need the bridge for, because there are some things that I think you will need. And I'm curious actually to test this out, because the last time I tested Bluetooth bulbs, the first time I tested them, I hated them because my house was bigger than the range. And then the second time I was trying Bluetooth mesh, and it still wasn't awesome. So I can't wait to see if this means Bluetooth mesh is actually more useful. So
these have Bluetooth 8.
Oh, hush. No. Oh, hush. They do not. All right. It's 8G. Bluetooth 8G. Okay. And final little bit, SmartThings. They have updated the app, and you can now integrate a hub-connected device. So this is any sort of Zigbee or Z-Wave device that connects through a SmartThings-compatible hub, rather, so like your Wink. And it will use the SmartThings cloud to execute those commands. So now you can have your hubs talk to your other hubs. It's great!
But it's all in the cloud, and I want local.
All right, well, this isn't for you. Hmm. You don't even want hubs. No. But if
I can help it, no.
If you do want hubs, this is good news. So, all right, now I think it's time for two things. One, the voicemail, but also the June winner.
Dun, dun, ooh, dun, that's dun, right. Dun, dun.
All right. And they win a Wyze sensor kit. So very exciting. And our winner is, we heard from him last week. This is Bobby, who asked us about leak sensors. Congratulations, Bobby. Yay.
You know, that's 2 months in a row that we've had the last caller actually win. And the funny thing is, we actually log all the calls in a spreadsheet and then ask the Google Assistant to pick a random number from 1 to the number of calls. And hey, it's kind of weird, but that's how it worked out.
That's also how we pick which questions we answer. No. So yes, it is random for any of you guys who are like, wait a second. But I encourage you, don't give up, because this week, and rather for the entire month of July, all our voicemail question askers will be entered to win a Schlage lock, because the IoT podcast hotline this month is brought to you by Schlage. Schlage's wide variety of smart locks lets you create the smart home of your dreams. Learn more about Schlage's smart home solutions and compatibility with Amazon, Apple, and Google Assistant products at schlage.com/IoT. So, if you want to be entered to win a Schlage lock, and why wouldn't you? Please give us a call on the hotline at 512-623-7424. And we may play it and answer your question on the air, and you will be entered to win. So, this week, let's hear from Larry.
Hi, this is Larry Reese. Feel free to use the message on the air. But my girlfriend and I moved in together, and I switched everything over from my Amazon Echoes, Google Home Minis, and what have you, to my account and put her on there. But I'm wondering, should we have our own accounts? And it's just her and I, but I'm sure this would be a question for larger families. We just got the Tile system, and I just added her under one account, and that's when the question popped up. Thanks. Love your show.
First off, Larry, congratulations for a big step in your life and relationship. There's a couple ways to answer this. One is by no means, no means at all, do two accounts because you will end up doubling up on all of your stuff. I have tried this. It's not good.
Mm-hmm.
So don't do that. Amazon will think you have two lights when you really only have one, and state gets messed up. It doesn't work. Just don't do it. Now, if it's already under your name and you don't want to mess with anything, just keep it there and she can still do the commands and that sort of thing. This is for Madam A households. And then the other option, though, and there are pros and cons to this, is creating an email account for your house. So have a house account that you tie into your Madam A account. The advantages are things like, I don't know if you use Spotify, but certain things that have limits associated with them will now be associated with your home. The downside is I don't remember how many adults you can have in a household, and you'll want your house email and account to be an adult. Then you may not be able to add your girlfriend to your account, which would, I don't know, it might be awesome for her because she could like order things on your account. I don't know. So we'd have to check that. But the challenge, if you don't do that, is location stuff will still work. But things like ordering, if you order stuff from Amazon, it won't work.
That's taking your relationship to a whole new level, Larry.
Yes.
Yes. I do have a question, only because you have multiple devices and multiple family members. Would you recommend in either platform going with like a voice match as well?
No. Never.
I thought you might not.
I hate the voice match. It doesn't work well for us. It might work well for you. And in that case, go for it. Because you also mentioned the Google Home and you said you might be switching to that. Same situation. I would say don't do voice match at all. If you do Google Home, you can each have your separate accounts and tie them to one Google device. Again,
right. That actually solves the problem because you then have that individual accounts and data all tied into one platform. But voice match has to work 100% or you're going to be miserable.
Yes. And voice match in our case did not, no matter how many times we trained it, it did not work well.
Right. So, and my family refuses to be trained. So I can't speak to it either.
So there's your answer, Larry.
You can always try the voice match. If it doesn't work, you know, disable it.
Yeah, that is true. Hopefully that helps, Larry. And now it is time to say goodbye to Kevin and say hello to our guest. Our guest coming up after the break is Andy Lowry, who is the CEO of RealWear. They make a connected head-mounted display that is voice-controlled for industrial settings. It's pretty cool, and they just raised $80 million, which is kind of a lot. So he's going to talk about why people use these, some use cases, and what they're going to do with all that money. Stay tuned for this and more. Hey everyone, we are taking a quick break from the Internet of Things podcast for a message from our sponsor. This week's sponsor is Dell Technologies, and I have Jason Shepard, who is CTO of IoT and Edge at Dell Technologies, here to talk to us. So Jason, last week we talked about EdgeX Foundry and how that's going. This week, let's talk about your scaling to the grail in Dell's strategy. What is Dell's Edge strategy, and how does it relate to EdgeX Foundry?
Yeah, so basically the strategy was get an architecture that works for the edge out in the open, create open interoperability through that collaboration, and then attach commercial value add to it. We're an infrastructure provider. We bring partners in for their domain expertise, and we wanted that EdgeX API that's developed through that collaboration to attach value add not only from ourselves, but also partners. So this open edge stack is taking VMware Pulse IoT Center as a device management platform, you know, for regardless of device and application. Our Photon OS, which is a Linux variant running containers. You can use any OS you want with EdgeX, but we'll curate an experience with it. Of course, EdgeX is part of that. So where you get the benefit of consistent security and management, open API driven by that EdgeX ecosystem, and then your choice of application stack. So as a developer, you can get started really quickly and easily, build on something that scales, but not get locked into any given platform, which is currently the case with many of the platforms that are creating their own APIs, their own SDKs, toolkits to get connected to their assets. They want to lock you in early, and we're giving people choice.
Okay. And in our conversations around this, you keep talking about scaling to the grail and data monetization around the edge. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. So scale to the grail, when I talk about that in my stuff online, it's really about this notion of pervasive sharing or monetization, especially on your terms of data, which is the obvious one, resources, compute, storage, networking, ride shares, anything consumable, services, your knowledge, scaling like that, sharing, selling across complete strangers. You know, I've never built a relationship with you before, but I'm able to sell you something. And the way you do that is you build pervasive trust. And to get to pervasive trust, you cannot have any single entity own the trust, you know, in a broader system of systems, public and private domains, et cetera. And so to get to the grail, you need technology to help. And you need an open edge. And so this is why, you know, we're investing heavily here. And then that enables you, it may sound far-fetched, this notion of pervasive, you know, data monetization, but also the only path there is an open edge. And so the scale to the grail is start now with a simple use case, just get going, solve a business problem, but take it on a path towards that ultimate goal.
That's great, Jason. So where can we go to find out more about Dell Technologies?
DellTechnologies.com/IoT is a good starting point, and then there's a bunch of links off of there to go learn more.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and today's guest is Andy Lowry, who is the CEO of RealWear. Hi Andy, how are you doing today?
Good, Stacey. Happy to be on the show.
Man, I am super excited to have you. We are about to talk about something that, I don't know if I've been skeptical, but we're about to talk about using AR in the workplace, in the enterprise, all the way from manufacturing to back-end warehouses, even to people riding around in ambulances. So there's a lot of stuff here. First off, Andy, let's talk about what it is that RealWear does.
Our mission here at RealWear is to train skilled industrial workers in situ. So we provide knowledge. And what I mean by that is there's tons of data out there in cloud, and there's tons of knowledge in an aging workforce. What we do is we provide a platform, which is a hardware wearable computer, a heads-up display computer that's an Android-driven tablet, but it's shaped in a way that fits on a hard helmet or a baseball cap so that you can wear it hands-free, and you communicate and control the system using your voice. And our particular voice that allows this hands-free control of a computer that you're wearing is done in very, very high noise environments. So up to 100 decibels, you can barely hear yourself speak, and you can still control the system much better, in most people's opinion, than Alexa and some of the other home systems. The device itself, if I were to give you an elevator pitch, we're in an elevator going up New York Tower, it'd take me only a few floors. The simplest way to pitch it is that it's an Android tablet. So start with that. It's got Wi-Fi, it's got Bluetooth, it's got a nice Qualcomm processor. It has a little micro display that looks like a heads-up display, which when viewed looks about like a 7-inch tablet held at arm's length. And then you have a voice system that uses a little bit of gestures, like your head moving left and right to scroll and slight things like that as a secondary input modality. But the primary modality is just voice. And so where a lot of systems out there today have swipes or gestures or HoloLens, people are familiar with the HoloLens types of gestures. They're this bloom and poke and drag. What we do is we do all of the heads-up display data by voice, and that's just been a very big differentiator compared to a lot of the other systems that are out there that do something a little bit more blended.
Okay, so we figured out what it is you guys do. Where does it make sense? What are the use cases that people are predominantly choosing your system for?
One of the simplest ways it's being used at the beginning is, you know, a lot of people talk about digitizing IoT, industrial IoT. And what we see on the home side is, you know, a lot of sort of fragmented but ever-growing IoT solutions, the smart refrigerator, the smart stove, this or that. On our side of the fence, IoT takes sort of an extra step. And I tell a lot of folks, I worked at Raytheon as a chief engineer, and iPhones came out in circa 08. Raytheon didn't allow an iPhone on campus for 4 years. And the reason was all the stuff we're dealing with now in the IoT space, it's stuff like security, safety, ergonomics, stability of the software, the company, and everything around it. So these are the types of things that enterprises need to check the block on when they're actually moving towards an acquisition or a more significant rollout. Consumers on the other side, you know, hey, new gadget comes out, they want to see the latest and greatest, they go to the Best Buy, they buy it, they integrate it and that sort of stuff. So in general, what we're doing is taking those same digital stuff, FaceTime, that sort of stuff, and applying it to the industrial sectors. But we're doing it in a way that conforms to all the industry requirements of not losing data, not secure, it has to be secure, and all of these different things.
And what about the use cases for these head-mounted displays in general?
Now, if you're asking specifically what it, when they get out there and they get deployed and they're all connected, what is it they're doing with these HMTs? Well, apart from doing capturing video and all that stuff, which was sort of the elements of the digitization revolution that we need, we need videos, we need content, we need stuff to put into these systems that aren't pieces of paper and written down notes. We need actual digital content. So it's a great machine to capture content because you can wear it and can move the boom arm out of the way with no display. Just wear it as a GoPro on your hard helmet. And everything you're doing, you can capture all day long. Or if you're in a warehouse, you might have a baseball cap on. You can capture your activity. And then those films can be basically sliced and diced and made little YouTube videos on how to do things inside the factory. But beyond the content capture, there's three major classes of software that get deployed. The first is collaboration software, where folks are talking to each other from a remote spot. So before, maybe someone would call a headquarters and use their telephone to just get a voice walkthrough on how to fix something. Now with the today's tech, it's not required to have only voice. You can actually do video and voice. So with video and voice, where you're sharing a screen and you're doing this hands-free, you're able to talk to the person, coach the person, but then show the person in the real world what we're talking about that you need to go do. So maybe switch this switch off. He can circle that switch with his laptop with his mouse and see that switch from your camera and then apply those, you know, circles appear on your little screen. So you're like, okay, that's the switch. And then the third category is the category of human-machine interface. And this has to do with the data visualization, but then also the control of machines. So you can think of Rockwell Collins, Mitsubishi, ABB, Emerson. A number of folks there have OT systems that basically have control paradigms that require you to stand at a stationary human-machine interface and control things and push buttons and do that sort of stuff. Well, in our system, you can take that software, put it on our computer. Now you can rove around the plant, and from anywhere in the plant, you'll be 500 yards away from a machine that has an alarm or overheats, and you can pull up that data. You can control the machine from 500 meters away in the same facility or even in an adjacent facility. So all of these things have been extremely powerful from an ROI perspective. Folks have come back to me and said, the ROI, like BMW came back and said, hey, 75% reduction in time to fix things and all that. And so there's no question that the return on investment's there.
I believe I have actually played with your glasses. I believe I tried them on in an Emerson user event at one point in time. So now I'm like, oh, I think I've done this. There are actual practical use cases. You mentioned that BMW has seen a 75% increase in productivity using this system. But why isn't everybody using it?
Well, it's just the time I think it takes really to get the enterprise feeling safe, secure, and stable enough with the device, the technology, and then the ecosystem of support around it. you know, specifically in the security dimension, you've got a lot of corporate forms and devices. They absolutely has to be encrypted. You can't take a sort of a back-end API and have sort of unencrypted data going from SAP to a device like ours. It absolutely has to have the right security. In the safety dimension, you can't deploy something to your folks that hopefully makes them work faster, then fundamentally makes them less safe. It just doesn't work. You just can't do that. Everything has to start with safety in today's day and age and then finish with a higher productivity. So safety is the second. And then third is just the stability. And what I mean by that is when we get into the deployments at scale, we're not talking about 50 or 100 units. We're talking about 10,000 to 100,000 units. And when you're talking about that amount of scale and investment, companies like Mitsubishi Electric, Japanese company, wants to see stability in the space and stability realware as a company to ensure that the support will be there for perpetuity.
So let's talk about some of the use cases you've got here, such as in remote guidance. You were telling me a little bit about some of the medical use cases. What are people doing?
Those are the type of use cases that get me most excited due to the impact and, you know, helping out people. We've got a couple different cases. So the first thing for the users, I know this is a radio podcast, so as people are listening to imagine, the first thing we're talking about here is FaceTime. We're literally talking about a version of a FaceTime. And I think most people know what that is, where you have the video and the voice and you're kind of at the same time collaborating. But we're doing this from the perspective of the eyes out versus two faces facing each other, because our camera's focused out into the world. So it can see through your eyes basically what you're looking at. So in the case of EMTs in both the countries of Finland and Norway, they've begun to deploy into the actual ambulances, HMTs. And what they do is they come across a young boy who might have fallen down and has a very nasty abrasion. They actually use the HMT as they're treating the person in situ where they find the young man. They treat that person in situ whilst they have an HMT-1 on. And what the HMT-1 is doing is through cellular networks, it's bringing that video data back to the emergency room that they're going to go to next and showing these doctors what exactly is going on without the EMT having to pause and stop and do anything. The EMT is just carrying out the resuscitative types of medical procedures. And at the same time, the doctors and nurses back at the emergency room are seeing what's going on. They can prepare, that means, for arrival. They can get the right beds, the right doctors, the right medical equipment ready and prepared. And then those precious minutes that can save can save lives.
Okay, well, there's a lot going on there. So in something like that, there's so many questions. Let's start with the technical questions. This seems like one of those, oh my gosh, 5G use cases, but we don't actually have 5G yet. So are these... Is this like an LTE network, or how does this work in practice from a network level and even from a business level? Who pays for these?
That's a great question, and there's lots of answers to it because it depends a little bit on where and who and what and why. Like, you even have issues in the U.S. because EMTs are often insured by a different insurance company than hospitals are, and so there's conflict in the business. You know, you say, hey, let's just do what's best for patients, but then you always run up against business challenges from time to time. I guess from a technology point of view, you're right. You've nailed it when you've focused on connectivity. Connectivity is what makes us effective. So first of all, it is not an LTE-driven Android tablet. It is a Wi-Fi only. So if we do go to LTE, we connect via hotspots. So Verizon has a hotspot, a number of other companies. Huawei has one that we actually connect to. And basically that then hands us off into the cellular network, mostly 4G. There are some localized 5G spots that Huawei and stuff are doing that are local to an actual facility that they've begun to sort of experiment with. But as far as, like you said, wide area coverage at 5G, that's not here yet. And as we're looking at wide area coverage of 5G, the frequency spectrum is all over the place, depending on where you are from a geography point of view. And so we do have plans to continue with a modularity approach, because our customers are so global that we need to be able to plug and play with an LTE modem that would work at 5G in China versus 5G in the US and so on. And so that's kind of on our roadmap for future products and everything else that will come out about the time 5G starts to gain momentum.
So you guys recently raised $80 million in debt and equity, and that is a lot of money. What are you guys going to do with that?
two major areas of thrust. One is around getting the deployments to be a little bit more easy to do. And what I mean by that is it's a lot of solution architecting right now that we're moving towards sort of a realware as a service model where we'll bundle things together into kind of a single offering and then just drop it in, install it, train, and then leave. And that sort of motion's different than today's motion where a lot of it is, hey, do a trade study on the hardware, do a trade study on the software, that sort of stuff. So being able to bundle it together and offer, you know, or one price per user per month for everything, installation, hardware, software, everything. On the tail of that is basically an expansion of our sales and services group, especially when it comes to the installation folks and the training folks and the technical folks that are customer facing, but nevertheless can help deploy. And then the second area is around research and development, mostly development in our case. So we've got two classes of products that sit sort of on the bounding edges of where we sit in the ecosystem and industries. And one is the HoloLens, which is a stereoscopic see-through system. We have ideas towards products that may make immersive AR a little bit more easy to do. So there's a better way to do that and still keep it safe than the way we're doing it today. And we've got work in progress right now that will segue eventually to something that looks more like immersive AR or something that would be able to sort of compare to immersive AR. And then on the other end of the spectrum, we have folks like Google Glass and a whole bunch of Chinese competitors in the same sort of weight class, if you will. So there is a need for lighter weight indoor systems as well. There's a couple different ways or routes we can go to market looking at lightweight systems. But basically, I have those from a hardware perspective in my bullseye. And then from a software perspective, it's all about the platform. So if each one of these HMTs are little birdies in a nest, if you think of them as birds, we need to build the nest as well. Make sure that nest is robust and comfortable. And when I'm talking nest, what most of them talking about is mobile device management, mobile application management, different microservices in the cloud to help enable these things. Because while you deploy 10,000 HMT1s or any wearable system for enterprise or even any phones or tablets for enterprise is very different than the way you do it as a consumer. Because as a consumer, you're kind of your own admin, your own IT. It's sort of a team of one. Whereas in enterprise, you're deploying 10,000 systems and you might have one admin who's running all 10,000 systems. And so it's a little bit different of a paradigm. So our Nest needs to be a little bit different than what Google provides consumers and others like that. And that's what we're building.
Got it. In a world where we have this awesome connectivity and we have this sort of technology in the Nest that you have so thoughtfully built for us, what becomes possible? What does that look like?
What we love to think about at RealWare, what we're doing is we're enabling sort of this 21st century maker. Because you think about the old furniture makers or folks that work with their hands. I come from a family of sheet metal workers. You know, folks that take a lot of pride in their artistry. We're actually enabling that next generation of digital workers with the same sort of a thing. So imagine going into school. We have a Clark College up the road from where we sit here in Vancouver, Washington, that trains new automotive technicians on how to do engine repair. Well, a part of their curriculum now for a day they spend learning about the HMT, because how that will turn them into a 21st century worker is so much faster than the workers 20th century, because they're able to get the basics learned and then move directly to a contributional sort of position on the team, because they have with them these digital tools to help them be this sort of half human, half computer type of seamlessly sort of merged together. You know, I watched, did you ever hear of something called Centaur Chess, Stacy?
I have no idea what that is.
Have you heard of it? This is a fascinating thing, and trust me, I mean, it came out with the beat of Garry Kasparov, who was the Grandmaster Chess Champion in 1997, was beat by Deep Blue, an IBM computer. And we all kind of echoed across the whole globe about this idea. Oh man, the computers are smarter than people. But what Garry did was say, nah, they're not smarter than us, because the computer didn't play the game of chess that I played. However, if I were to partner with a computer, that would sort of maximize what a computer's good at and what a human's good at. And he called that Centaur Chess. Centaurs are these mythological creatures, half horse, half man. The idea would be the man would be the intelligent, intuitive, creative type source of knowledge, and the horse would be your brute strength. power, crank through options, you know, make sure it's error proof, that sort of thing. And by calling it a centaur, it was a little bit more harmonious than a cyborg or something. Some people call it cyborg chess. But this chess is played at the highest level of chess in the history that's ever been played. I mean, it's virtually error proof, and you've got the greatest chess minds in the world creatively dueling each other on a chessboard at a very high level. What we're doing is doing the same. We're creating a centaur workforce. So this workforce of centaurs that will be equipped with digital sorts of tools like the HMT that go into the field and take a vocation that they're very well paid. I mean, these folks will be well compensated because of their skills are so much higher than a conventional non-digital worker that has to go back, oh, I'm not sure how to fix this. Let me get someone else out there. Let me figure that out. Okay, get my supervisor there. A digital worker will be able to dial those people in at the speed of light. So even though that sounds so minor, it is massive when you try to extrapolate that out to a global scale. And as we're building infrastructure of things like wind power and geothermal and all of these things that will beget a world that will be truly lower and lower marginal costs, truly less and less dependent on scarce resources, so that the idea of a sharing economy, something that if you're interested in that, Jeremy Rifkin does a very good speech on this from Wharton, about a sharing economy where we reduce the marginal costs of anything that we do, energy we make, logistics, and then knowledge to nearly zero. And then in that sort of context, we build a world that is a lot less prone to have us fighting over the scraps like we do today, like we did in the industrial age. Well, the centaur workforce for the next few generations will be the workforce that actually implements that infrastructure necessary to build a world that is much more orientated on creativity and the potential of the human race versus fighting over little scribbles and scraps.
Okay, that's a fun big vision. All right, well, Andy, I feel like I've learned a lot. Thank you so much for coming on the show this week.
You're very welcome, Stacey. I had a great time.
That's it for this week. Thanks so much for listening. And remember, if you'd like more IoT news, sign up for my newsletter at stacyoniot.com. We'll see you next week.